Hello and Happy New Year from Lunch with Leon. Yes, we're into a new year of podcasts and, of course, everything new at ITT Hub. So back in episode 31, nearly 2 years ago, I had on the show one of my great friends, Roger Davis. Roger, a straight-talking commentator, great views on public transport globally, and himself a former senior bus manager. I was really pleased when Roger agreed, by popular demand, to come back and do another episode of Lunch with Leon.
Well, Roger, here you are back by popular demand from our listeners who very much loved the episode we did together over a year or so ago now. So welcome back. And we said at the time, didn't we, that we didn't have enough time to talk about all the things we wanted to talk about. And so here we are now. In the knowledge that we're probably not going to get a transport bill, so we're not going to get Great British Railways formed in this immediate period. We've had the budget and we're living through the most incredible times, aren't we?
I think first and foremost, many, many thanks to listeners and to you for inviting me back. I'm very flattered and to a certain extent emboldened. And I have a horrible suspicion we're going to have the same problem at the end of this. As you've just said, there's so much going on that I'm not sure we're going to have enough time, but let's give it a go. Where do you want to start off with? Should we, a little while back, there was a budget. Now, I am very, very cynical about budgets because I don't think anybody ever does well out of them. Somewhere along the line, even if you think you're going to get something, somewhere along the line, you end up paying for it. And I suppose at least we can say about this, the budget that happened a while back in the autumn statement or whatever it was, is that at least the Chancellor was honest and said, you're all going to pay more. So I suppose we've got to be grateful for that. Personally, of course, I was disappointed he didn't take the golden opportunity to scrap HS2. But the fact of the matter remains, it's still a dreadful scheme that will never fulfil the objectives it sets out to achieve. So, and as the first trains won't run for over 10 years, and then only have a little section from somewhere near the centre of Birmingham to somewhere nobody's ever heard of in northwest London, and the chances of it getting to Manchester before about 2040, goodness knows what. So there's still plenty of time left for it to be cancelled. And I regard it as a stay of execution rather than a reprieve. But I think if we really genuinely believe that we want to do things for future generations, this thing, you know, it's costing an enormous amount of money. It will never make a bean, so it'll have to be subsidised forever. So the best thing we could do for the future generations is to cancel it. As much as we know about it, I mean, it's so covered with gagging orders. It's a bit like, you know, as if it's got Harry Potter's invisibility cloak over it. So we hardly ever hear anything, about it. What we do hear is always bad news. It's costing money. We've got to rebuild a tunnel or something. So, yeah, you know, I still remain my same view that I've held right the way throughout this project.
You're in great company with HS2, like with Lord Berkeley and others who have opposed it. I mean, I suppose we've got to a position now where we know a few things, don't we? The journey time saving is no longer of the value that it once was because travel time is not dead time anymore, because provided you're not stood up in the vestibule, you can be working or talking on the phone or reading or whatever it is you want to be doing. So it can only be on capacity grounds. And the post-COVID thing is that quite a lot of the capacity we might have thought we needed, we don't seem to need anymore. So if it's not capacity and if it's not journey time savings, what is it? And I think what I'm left with is, firstly, I suppose it's providing employment and therefore tax revenues for many thousands of people involved in the construction. And sometimes when you build something, something else happens around it. So a bit like building the Docklands Light Railway to Beckton. Of itself, it wasn't much COP, but eventually people built things around it and capitalized on the connection. So maybe it spurs on some development potential and maybe it creates its own demand.
I think you've hit the nail on the head a bit there, that the people who support it probably support it for the wrong reasons. It's a construction project, but by heck, you know, we could use people in the construction industry for far more positive things than this. I begin to question this whole thing about, you know, how things spur on development, which I think it kind of leads us on to levelling up. Now, I'm sure you, like me, have a whole toolbox of phrases so that when you're writing something or you're doing a press release or something, you have the, and you have to get these phrases in. You know, they've got to be in there. And currently, of course, it's leveling up. Everything has to be leveled up. I'm not sure I've got a clue what it actually really means, but I think I know what it doesn't mean. And what it doesn't mean is whisking people quicker from Leeds to Manchester or from Birmingham to London. What it actually means is having the jobs in Leeds or in Birmingham. And this whole concept of whizzing people about the place seems to me to be completely at variance with the idea of levelling up, where you're trying, you know, you're trying to get build up local economies and making it easy for people to go somewhere else doesn't seem to me to achieve that. So I think that there's a kind of a conflict there. And then moving on, and, you know, I mean, you know, my thought processes will zigzag about a bit here. I think if we're really serious about saving the planet and about the environment, and I prefer to use the phrase the environment because it's all encompassing, it means everything to do with the environment. If we're really serious about that, then we need to reduce travel. Now, I'm not talking here about people whizzing off for a fortnight to the Mediterranean. That's a sideshow. What I'm talking about here is what people do for 48 weeks of the year, the regular commute. Now, for reasons that we couldn't avoid over the last couple of weeks, we have driven through evening peak in Manchester, Sheffield, Huddersfield and Halifax. I don't drive, so I can observe from the comfort of the passenger seat. Now, there weren't that many people, I should think, going to Kendal, so we were a bit unusual. But it occurred to me that all the people who were out there, all the other people, and we weren't gridlocked, but we were in slow-moving stop-start traffic on the M60 in Manchester, on the A roads in the other places. And I thought, all these people do this every day, and they're making incredibly varied, dispersed journeys because we can live and work wherever we like. And we do. And I was sitting there thinking, there is not a public transport solution on the planet, not high speed rail, not Northern Powerhouse rail, not Metrolink, not bus franchising, that can make a dent in what I'm seeing going on around me here and what I know goes on every day. And there is only one solution. And the solution is to remove the need to travel. So we come round to, in these sort of words, you know, this world of little sound bites that we live in, my slogan is save the planet, work from home. Now, okay, not everybody can work from home, but a lot of people can, an awful lot more people can, or can at least for part of the time, or can work in local hubs. I'm going to give you an example. Here in Cumbria, our largest employer is Sellafield. They employ about 11,000 people and staggeringly 48,000 in supply chain jobs dependent upon it. Huge employer. And pre-COVID, they discovered they'd got a number of people who lived in Milham. Now, with all due respect to Milham, it's a little bit out of the way. And people had to commute by driving up the A595, which is fairly notorious in these parts. Visitors will enjoy it because it's a lovely ride with nice views. But if you've got to do it 5 days a week through all weathers, it's not so much fun. So Sellafield established a hub in Milham Library, which delighted the library. And now the people who live in Milham work in Milham. And along the way, the traffic levels on the A595 have been reduced. I think that's the future. I think that's showing us the future. And I think that that's the way we should be looking. It revives. So what we're doing there is, if you like, if we expand this and say that this is a kind of principle that we should be applying wherever, for home or local hub working, where, and I believe it to be quite widely possible. I don't think it does much for the planet in encouraging people to commute. There's no such thing as green commuting, and then plonking them into energy hungry office blocks. Where they've got their lights on all day and they've got their central heating on and their air con on and computers whirring away. That doesn't seem to me to be a way that we're going to save the planet, look after the environment.
So, Roger, Okay, yeah. Work from home. So let's pretend that you and I are in gainful employment. and you decided to work from home.
Mm-hmm.
So now I'm going to charge you business rates on your home,
mm-hmm.
because I was getting business rates from your office, but you're mm-hmm. not in your office anymore because as part of your plan, you've downsized or closed the office, no longer getting the business rates revenue. So now I'm going to have to charge it to you on your home.
Right.
How do you feel about that?
Okay, the thing here is when I was gainfully employed, for most of my career, I was a bus chief, and therefore I had to be available 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. So my home phone number was broadcast far and wide. In recognition of that, the company paid a contribution towards my home phone bill. Now, I think in the scenario we're talking about here, where you're talking about business rates, but lots of companies saving a lot of money on their energy and having either no offices or smaller offices, I think you can apply the same thing in saying, well, we're going to share some of those savings with you. So we'll make, as you're using your home, we will contribute to the cost, whether it be energy bills or rates bills, we will make a contribution towards that and therefore share some of the savings with you. I think that would be a perfectly reasonable excuse. I'd be quite happy with that.
So in my case, where of course I am working from home, because that's the only place I have, where I have the chance to do meetings face-to-face, I nearly always choose to do that for a whole series of reasons. On Zoom, there's no creativity. We have a meeting. It starts at 2. It finishes at 3. We had an agenda. We go through the agenda. What we didn't have is we didn't have the cup of tea before the meeting. We didn't have the loitering outside the meeting afterwards, in which we talked about some other stuff. We didn't have the chance meeting with certain other people, and did it today. I did a meeting this morning across town. So I'm an offender in your. I went across town on the underground to go to a meeting that I could easily have done by Zoom. And in fact, most of the other people were on Zoom. But on the margins of that meeting, I learned something very important from a chance encounter with somebody mm-hmm. in the office who told me something that I didn't know and concerned me.
Mm-hmm.
So where I'm concerned about this working from home lark, and I understand mm-hmm. your entire macro point about reducing the amount of traveling that people do, mm-hmm. working from home in isolation is only tolerable for a while mm-hmm. because you don't get the creativity. Young people don't learn anything. They don't watch the behaviors of others. Management skills are not developed. And as I say, you don't get the chance encounters that sometimes gives you a bright idea for something new or an insight into something that you didn't know. So where I feel we're headed is we are traveling to work less, but we're moving, it seems to me, to be working from the office 2/3 of the time and working mm-hmm. from home 1/3 of the time. Mm-hmm. And people are telling me now they have anchor days, so they only have to go into the office a couple of days a week. But one of those mm-hmm. days is an anchor day, which means everybody in the same team is in on the same day. Mm-hmm. And sometimes there's a company-wide anchor day and everybody has to be in on a Thursday because that's when they do their stuff together. So that reduces travel, but doesn't eliminate mm-hmm. it, right?
No, but I'm not saying, you know, everybody should work from home. What I'm saying is that it's a far greater mix than we've been used to in the past, and very much the sort of things you've been saying, which I agree with. I mean, I wouldn't disagree with the points you're making, but I think that, you know, this whole concept this whole 9-to-5 Monday to Friday commute, that is the key problem that we face, and we really, really must try and kill that. We've got to try and flatten travel demand. And it's reducing the need to travel will do that. And more home working, more local hub working, more hybrid working are all parts of reducing the amount of travel that we do for the vast majority of the year. And I think that those are the targets we should be setting for ourselves. Young people, if I may use that phrase, that's terribly... I think people these days are so used to working with technology, they're far more used to it than I am, And that I think that the suggestion that you should have a kind of a fixed period of time in an office is probably anathema to a lot of people who are coming into industries. Now, there's no one single solution, but I think we have to get away from the single solution that we had, and we have to make our way to this sort of a new way of working, a new way of dealing with all these things. And I think if you look at the implications of that, you know, we can, if we get rid of the peak hour, we solve the problems of congestion and pollution, we contribute towards saving the planet. If you're working at home, or if you're working locally in a local hub, where'd you go and get your sandwich for lunch? You get it from a local shop. Where do you buy your post stamps? You buy it from your local post office. So we help revitalize our local high streets. You know, it's all these sort of things come off the back of a change in the way we approach, a new way of thinking about how we do these things. And if we get all those sort of things all as byproducts, I mean, you know, what's not to like, really?
And a lot of what you describe with the congestion, of course, is car commuting.
Yeah.
Which is the big problem, because car is such a hugely inefficient user of road space.
Yeah.
Of course, there was a time when we could blame congestion for pollution. But of course, increasingly, as electric vehicles become more commonplace, there's a divorce now between congestion and the environment, because as my listeners know, I have an electric car. I am one of those smug people who is standing in the queue of traffic, knowing that I am not contributing any pollution, certainly not at the tailpipe end of it. And I am sat there not paying any road tax,
well, yet.
At least until April 25 anyway, but not paying any road tax, not paying any congestion charge, and only paying £18 to fill it up. So I'm sat there all smug. But in fact, a city full of electric cars creating no pollution is still a city going nowhere. And it's the purpose of the journey that is the problem, really.
That's it, exactly. So that's why I say there are so many spin-offs, so many kind of additional benefits that you get from breaking ourselves away from this obsession with the peak.
One of the other problems, Roger, is that with cars, is that your car is like another room in your house.
It's a mobile room.
It's decorated the way you want it decorated. It's furnished the way you want it furnished. It's got your chocolate or your drinks or your CDs. Or whatever, and the only difference with this room in your house is it's capable of moving on its own. So it's easy to get in and use it, isn't it? Which is why the business about us all being in autonomous Ubers in the future is quite a far-fetched idea. Because I don't necessarily want to travel in somebody else's little Uber. I want to travel with my radio station, my seat position, my everything.
That's why car sharing doesn't work. You're right. I mean, a car is the same, as we've both said now, a mobile room, and people will not be weaned off the car. What we need to do, and I think we're probably, you know, we're flogging the passed away equine if we say we're going to try and stop people using their cars. What we have to do is we have to accept the fact that people use their cars and manage it. Now, if we're looking at a world of far greater local travel, there's only two shows in town when it comes to local travel, and that's the car and the bus. Cycling, walking and what have you have their place. E-scooters, which are fearsomely dangerous to pedestrians. I lived with them in San Francisco for a month and scared the living daylights out of them. But these things, the problem with these things is they are not inclusive. They're not available to everybody. But cars and buses are. Now, if our aim is exactly as you've been saying, is to avoid excessive use of the car, basically manage the car, then the bus is the obvious alternative, because it is just as accessible. It's accessible to all. That's, if I remember rightly, what bus, short for omnibus, means. And therefore, those are the things that we should be concentrating on. You'll never beat the car on convenience at the home end of things, but you might be able to beat it At the destination end. So if the bus can get into a pedestrianised area, if it can drop you off near the shops or offices or whatever it may be where you're headed in an undercovered shelter, whereas to get from a car park you have to walk in the rain, you're giving an advantage there. May I use the phrase of saying you're beginning to level up? We therefore have to get a recognition of the importance of the bus. And I see it having, you know, having an important role to play in the future. Obviously, all these changes have a seismic effect on public transport. And I'm afraid that, you know, I think for rail-borne modes, the future is not, you know, as they are so dependent on the longer distance travel and on commuting. It's I would predict that within, you know, 5-10 years we're actually going to have a significantly smaller rail network, and I think the trade unions aren't daft, and I think they see that, and I think the current industrial unrest that we have is them saying let's get the best conditions we can while we still can.
And you know, we did miss an opportunity. If there was a time to reform rail pay and conditions, it was in the period starting about March 2020.
For the first time,
there were no passengers, there was no work to be done, and the prospect of a sort of job for life was suddenly not quite so keen. Now, we missed that opportunity. I mean, we were, of course, all because there was a life-threatening pandemic sweeping through the country and indeed around the world. So rail reform, in terms of conditions and so on, really wasn't on the agenda. But now, of course, that opportunity is missed. And, I mean, the future of the rail industry, I mean, one of the most frightening things is that the Department for Transport doesn't really know what its budget outturn as a whole is going to be each year, because the rail number is such a big number. It's fiendishly difficult to predict. You can easily underspend and you can easily overspend if you're not careful. It's a nuisance. I hear a lot of people who tell me, needless to say, well, of course, if rail travel was cheaper, more people could afford it. Well, of course, the cost of rail travel isn't designed to reflect affordability. It's designed to reflect the cost of employing the staff, owning the rolling stock, the track, the stations, and providing the signalling. And your rail fare is just your slice of that. And so it's not meant to be affordable. It's designed to reflect the cost of running it. And so I get annoyed when people throw this, because I'm sorry that it is, in anybody's mind, expensive, but so is track, and so is signalling, and so is labour, and so are locomotives, and so are carriages, and so on.
You get this thrown all the time. I have it all the time, and I have it still now in things I'm involved in now. As soon as I mention the word bus, people say they're too expensive.
Yes, yeah.
Immediately, that's the immediate reaction. And it's the same as you've just said about trains, the same applies with buses. You're not actually just you're paying for the whole thing up front, basically. And I had a little bit of a run-in with the local Chamber of Trade recently, who suddenly went on about bus fares being so expensive. And I went to a lovely bar that overlooks, it's a bonus on Windermere, and it overlooks where the boats go from. And I was going to go on one of the boats, so we get residence discount, you see. And I thought, I'll just have a glass of wine before my boat goes. And I went into this bar, and I always pay contactless. So, you know, it's a tremendous boon, huge advance in my view. So the fact of the matter is I really haven't got a clue how much things cost. I just go like that. And the bloke, I called the bloke, and he said to me, £8.75. I thought, what? And so I got in touch with the Chamber of Trade, and I said, you know, this is, do you know, for £8.50, as it was then, you can have the freedom, you can travel on all the buses in the Central Lake District for £8.50. So before you bang on about bus fares, I suggest you have a word with your own members.
Yeah.
And people don't make that you know,
I suggested on a forum the other day. So here in London, we have a flat bus fare, which is £1.60. Sure. If you make a third bus journey, you're caught by the cap. If you're doing a mixture of bus and rail journeys, you're caught by a different cap, and that cap also applies not only by the day. So here's what I suggested. I suggested the single London bus fare should always be the price of a medium latte in Costa Coffee.
Right.
On the basis that if you're prepared to pay £3.25 for a spoonful of coffee, some hot water, and a splash of milk in a plastic paper cup, then frankly, you deserve to pay that for a bus ride. Because if you are prepared pay that much money for a paper cup full of coffee that probably cost, I don't know, 10 pence to make, 20 pence.
Yeah.
You surely ought to be prepared to pay that for a bus fare where you're going to travel on £300,000 worth of equipment. You're going to be paying a driver £35,000-£45,000 a year. You want him to be safe. You want him to be trained. You want him to be licensed. You want the bus to have air conditioning, heating. You want it to have leather seats, and you want it to be in pristine condition. That's what you should have to pay. And I can't reconcile in my mind why sophisticated purchasers will shell out £3.25 for their cup of coffee without thinking about it, but tell me that the bus fare is too expensive.
Yes.
So my only solution, Roger, my only solution is to link one with the other.
You know, I think you're right. And I mean, here, you know, the industry itself has to take a certain amount of blame, because we've never promoted ourselves properly, really. We're regarded in many quarters as being some little cottage industry that exists solely to run rural buses and be on hand to provide rail replacement services. So many people do not realise that the bus is the major form, by far the major form, of urban transport in this country, and is vitally important. And we need to get that message across, because it's so easy for people to say, well, you know, it's nothing to do with us. And that's the trouble we have at the moment. You know, local authorities tend to wash their hands of it. And then we get groups who say, oh, you know, buses should be state run. They should be renationalised. And I say, you know, let's take another example here in Cumbria. At the first whiff of austerity, the county council withdrew all its subsidised bus services, scrapped the lot. So all the buses in Cumbria are commercially provided by operators. So therefore, all the publicly funded, you know, the publicly run bus services, which incidentally the county council had run for over 40 years, goes right back to 1974 local government reform. So I reckon that was a bit of a cop out between you and me and everybody else. But so if you think that that is a good advert for publicly run bus services, I would suggest that, you know, our example here in Cumbria is not a very good example of that at all. And if it wasn't for the commercial activities of the local operators around here, we wouldn't have any buses.
No. And look, for goodness sake, the laws of economics don't change if you move from private to public ownership.
Right.
At the end of the day, everything is run by the local authority, if everything's run by the state, the price of vehicles, the price of labor.
Exactly.
All the big ticket items cost the same amount of money. There is no magic in public authority ownership. No. Arguably, they're less efficient. Arguably, the private sector is sharper. That rule is not foolproof, but the point is, changing the ownership does not magically change the economics. And I think going forward, I hope that the Treasury believes that the bus recovery grant that operators are still enjoying post-COVID is worth continuing with. It's a small amount of money in the great scheme of things. Ridership has been affected. And frankly, the industry now having got pretty well hooked on it with its post-COVID, bus services could easily be severely reduced if something on that doesn't carry on. Any cost of anything on rail ever, the amount of money the government puts into bus services is very small.
It's probably a day's work on HS2, but I think it is very important that is continued. But again, it's getting across the recognition of the importance of buses. And so many people I talk to outside the industry are absolutely staggered when I say, you know, trains aren't very important. Not that many people use them, but buses are. And they're absolutely flabbergasted, which is, you know, it's a bit sad. But one of the things, not only do we need to ensure that the industry is as you said, you know, we continue with the support for it, but also in order to meet the challenges in the future, the bus industry needs to be very agile and very flexible. You need to be able to react to changing circumstances very quickly. Now, as far as I'm concerned, the 1985 Act is still law. So, you know, the situation is there to do it. Unfortunately, rigid franchises will not do the job. They will not be appropriate. They are no longer fit for purpose, because the industry has got to be able to react fast, and a rigid franchise system will not be able to do that and not allow buses to meet their full potential in the coming years.
I tell you what that reminds me of. It's a little bit like politicians only have really black and white.
Now
in the environment, in the net zero, diesel bad, electric good.
Yeah.
Now that completely avoids the fact that a Euro 6 diesel engine is miraculous in how little pollution. Mm-hmm. Miraculous.
Almost clean the air as it goes.
Yeah, difficult to measure in some cases. But in the politics, electric good, diesel bad. So I was with the coach operators team, and they were making a very strong case for some latitude to use renewable sources of diesel in Euro 6 coaches until the technology developed further to allow zero emission long distance vehicles to come by. And the government won't hear of it. It's just no.
No, well, we're running ahead of ourselves in this country. Can I just say, you've just reminded me there again, this black or white with politicians is the senior bus pass, which is, it has to be free, even if that means there's no bus. And that's what happened around here in a number of cases where people have a bus pass but no bus, and the people said, we're happy to pay a fare. We're happy, and the government said, no, it's free, and therefore we haven't got a bus. So that kind of black and white thinking. On electric vehicles, I think, again, and I have a very strong belief that we can learn a lot from the Americans about public transport, which is not something that's a generally held view, but I mean, certainly is my view, that they get quite a lot of things right. In terms of electric vehicles, they are being much more cautious. My favorite San Francisco Muni has only got 9 electric buses, three different types, which they're trying out. I mean, they do have a massive trolley bus fleet, but they're being much more cautious. One operator has scrapped all his electric buses in California because they caught fire in the heat. Others have found that electric buses don't generate enough power to keep them warm in -2 or -3 degrees for the customers to be cozy. So they're taking a much more cautious approach. I don't believe the technology is there yet, but we're rushing into it. And as you say, and it's again all part of, you know, there's this, we should have a train or we should have a light rail. Yes, we'll have that without even questioning whether it's the right thing. And it comes back to, I think, some of these. And I'm going to give you two kind of fun examples of the way these things come about. One is, there are more canals in Birmingham than there are in Venice. Well, there aren't. It's just some guy in the West Midlands a couple of years ago thought that'd make a good slogan. And I once got told off by a young lady on a Manchester Metro link for actually disputing that fact. And then my other favourite, Nowheresville, Montana, little mom and pop restaurant. And in the window it says, best burger in the USA. Who's to challenge it? And you get these things. So it's like, trains are green, right? No, they're not. Look at any station car park. Epps Fleet, I won't call it international because there's no international trains there. When that was built, they had to widen the M25 and the A2 to cater for all the additional car traffic that domestic high-speed trains generated. So you get these things. There's this thing about, if it's got rails and overhead wires, it builds confidence. Well, I live on the West Coast Main Line. And I tell you, the only confidence I have the train is going to turn up is when it rolls round the corner into Oxenholme Railway Station. The fact it's got rails and overhead wires doesn't build confidence in me. So there are these things, and I think, you know, what we should be doing, instead of just sitting back and accepting them, you know, we should actually challenge them and say, I'll tell you, I caught a bus in Manchester the other week, and I got on this bus, and it was very well used. And I have to tell you, there was absolutely nothing wrong with it, right? And I mean, having worked in the industry, I'm probably more critical than the average thing. It was absolutely fine. And I hear these people standing up and saying, we're going to fix the buses. And I said, why? What needs fixing? And I think, you know, really, we need to be far more aggressive in challenging people. Come straight out and say these things and say, what do you mean by that? You know, what if you say that, you know, my other pet one is people, again, it's another in the toolbox of phrases, integrated transport. What is integrated transport? What does integrated transport mean? What does it mean to the average customer? And I think, you know, we really need to be less passive and more aggressive, if you will, in putting our case and challenging these black and white statements, as you put it.
Roger, you're so right. And in fact, I was only talking to somebody the other day who just told me, of course, that under state ownership, there would be better integration between bus and rail, with connections. And of course, you know, and I tell by the smile on your face, you know exactly what I'm going to say.
Yes.
I said, connections in which direction? What do you mean? Well, either the bus is going to get there before the train so that bus passengers can catch the train, or the bus is going to get there after the train so the train passengers can catch the bus. You can't have it both ways unless both forms of transport are required to wait, which is very unpopular. So firstly, integration only works in one direction, and you've got to decide which direction you want it to work, and that'll work for many people but not for all people. It will appear to some people that the bus left just before the train because in fact the bus was bringing people for the train, so you get all that. And then there is this business about fares and ticketing, and I have often on this program talked about how sophisticated purchasers go to supermarkets and choose different sorts of baked beans, different sorts of washing powder, different sorts of, make very sophisticated choices about food, about other goods in the supermarket. And they literally come with a basket, a literal basket, of what for them is their best value for money. And it's a trade-off between quantity, quality, and price.
Yes, 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 yes.
The person is now too stupid to understand a bus ticket and a rail ticket? This is crazy.
Absolutely, you know, the technology exists. You wander on with your credit card, you flash the credit card, and the technology should automatically charge you the cheapest fare.
Yeah.
You know,
you should trust it to do that, and probably trust it more than you would even trust a human behind the counter to know the right fare. As ever, we've used up all of our time, so I'm going to have to ask you to come back again because we'll never finish this subject. So this is just tremendous. Thank you. I'm beginning to think of our conversations a bit like therapy. So maybe I could have another half an hour on the couch with you. I certainly feel better at the end.
I'm not sure we should leave that bit in, you know.
No. And what you were saying about people's perceptions, I was fascinated to read on Twitter. Somebody said that she thought it was disgraceful that half the people in this country are below average intelligence. Well, that's how averages work.
Yes.
In this country are below average height. They're below average weight, because averages are the midpoint across a range. So half the population will be below average intelligence, because that's how averages work. And this sort of person, Roger, has a vote.
Yes. Yes, yes, absolutely. Okay.
Roger, once again, absolutely fabulous to have you on the show. Thank you very much for finding the time.
It's a pleasure. I hope you, listeners enjoy it.
Thank you very much indeed. So this has been Lunch with Leon, a fabulous canter through a whole range of subjects with my great friend Roger Davis, who many people have asked me to bring back on the show because they enjoyed our first encounter. If you're a recent convert to this particular podcast and you've not heard Roger's previous episode, please look back. They're all still there, available wherever you get your podcast from. Lunch with Leon is an ITT Hub production. Please take a look at us at itthub.co.uk, which is a brilliant event in May 2023 at Farnborough International. Please come to the show. Please come and see us. And of course, please subscribe and listen to our podcast. In the meantime, once again, Roger, thank you very much indeed.
My pleasure. My pleasure.